activity in Arbora Global Company. Now in its 35th year, the firm provides leadership and career success services for 21% of the 100 companies named Best Employers in the United States by Fortune Magazine, plus two of the four big four CPA firms and 12% of the largest 15 Boston law firms. Core services include leadership services, that's retain search plus onboarding, high potential leadership coaching, and helping leaders in transition managing their careers to success. Larry is a licensed psychologist with a doctorate from Harvard University. Each month, Stiebel PBA writes the Platform for Success column in Psychology Today magazine. Stiebel PBA has a special relationship with FEI. And now let me introduce Larry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you. I'm taping this presentation, and in about a week, it'll be on our website along with these PowerPoints. But if you want to give me your business card, I'll make sure that you get the URL. So you don't have to take any notes. But during the course of the evening, I'm going to ask you to write things down that are not for sharing, but it would be useful if you had a pad or something to write on. Many of you are in transition, and this talk is really not about job search. It's about managing careers effectively. For those of you who are in transition, may I suggest you go to stiebelpeabody.com, S-T-Y-B-E-L-P-E-A-B-O-D-Y, stiebelpeabody.com, and look under resources. And then one of the resources is called From Ideas to Action. And we've got a whole bunch of articles that deal with career management and also job search. Rules of the road, please interrupt me at any time. Don't wait for me to finish.
If I say
S-T-Y-B-E-L-P-E-A-B-O-D-Y, stiebelpeabody.com. And then you want to go to resources, and then resources, ideas to action. Just scroll down, you'll find something. Goal is to look at differential diagnosis of workplace relationships, give you a tool for you and your subordinates and your team so that they can diagnose workplace relationships and then take action. I was at a law firm. It's not a client of mine, but they decided to cut a number of attorneys. And the CFO, who also happened to be the chief business officer, his attitude was, once they're off the payroll, they're out of my life. Once they're off the payroll, I'm not going to have to deal with them anymore. And so his attitude about termination was, let's do it the cheapest way that we possibly can to save money. A not unreasonable thing to do for a company that's in trouble. The problem is, he was wrong. He's looking at this from a very closed system perspective. And the reality is that this law firm, like CPA firms, like universities, they're open systems. People are constantly talking with their colleagues in other universities, in other law firms. And so these people that were let go felt they had been sort of kicked in the ass and treated without respect. And so that came to bite this company. The problem was not that he was wrong. The problem was his diagnosis. He looked at these as these are simply workplace colleagues, and once they're off the payroll, they're not colleagues anymore, they're strangers. Why should I give a crap? But they're not. One of our clients is McKinsey & Company, and they're the extreme opposite end. And and McKinsey, like CPA firms, like law firms, there's constant turnover. People go into McKinsey knowing that most of them are going to be fired from McKinsey. But McKinsey's attitude is, once you're off the payroll, you are now a McKinsey alum. Because if you were good enough to get into McKinsey, you're good enough to be hired by a potential client that could employ McKinsey in the future. And so we want to cultivate you, even while we're firing you. And it's very interesting that when we do outplacement work for McKinsey, they charge our fees to marketing, not human resources. They look at it as business development expense. This brings me to one of the key themes of tonight, what I call the knowledge worker paradox. Many of you are from universities. I see this all the time in universities. I see this all the time in life science companies, R&D. I see it in CPA firms. And the knowledge worker paradox is this: extraordinary, exquisite, highly sophisticated ability to diagnose situations within one's technical sphere of competence, combined with sloppy thinking about diagnosing workplace relationships. That can be okay for an individual contributor, but if work has to be done with and through people in teams, that spells disaster. And I'm sure, does anybody here know what I'm talking about? Has anybody ever met somebody in their life who you would say suffers from the knowledge worker paradox? Exquisite sensitivity to diagnosing situations in a technical sense, combined with sloppy and imprecise thinking about relationships at work. Anybody ever meet somebody like that? Why should you care? Why is that important? Well, first, it has to deal with promotability. If you're ever going to get out of being the controller and move to being a CFO, you have to be perceived as having the ability to be more than a cop. This is an important picture. And I didn't understand how important this picture was until this weekend. I was with a friend who is in a law firm, and he was saying, things are really great because their key partner is really good friends with the chief legal officer at Merrill Lynch, let's say. And most of their business is Merrill Lynch business. And he saw that as an advantage and one of the reasons he joined the firm. And I told him, that's a disadvantage and one of the reasons you ought to be concerned about the firm. When you have a strong cable that ties one individual to another individual, okay, that can be weak. What I'm looking for in a firm, particularly a professional services firm like yours, is many weak relationships. In the Gulliver's Travel story, it's not one strong cable that ties Gulliver, it's many, many threads. Many, many weak threads. Why do I say that's an important picture? When you're dependent on one person for the economic value of your firm, that's too great a dependency. I'm thinking specifically, anybody remember the firm Testa Hurwitz? Mm-hmm. I mean, great firm. They hired the best and brightest lawyers, and everybody had a relationship with Dick Testa until Dick Testa died. And then once that bond was broken, everything collapsed. So strong bonds can actually be weak, and many weak bonds can actually be strong, in my model. Any questions? Diagnosis. Companies spend millions of dollars. Anybody from life sciences here? Life sciences spends millions of dollars to provide tools for scientists to conduct proper diagnosis. Anybody from healthcare here? Healthcare delivery. Hospitals do that. Universities do that. Millions of dollars for proper diagnosis, but very few companies spend any money to teach employees how to diagnose relationships in work settings, and yet most of the work gets done in teams. So the first thing is to call things by their proper name. And whether you agree with my system or not, at least I'm providing a common language so people can engage in a conversation. That's part of why this is important. You may not be able to see this, but this is the matrix. And again, I can send you the PowerPoint slides. There are six different kinds of workplace relationships and two factors. The first factor is affect. That's emotions. The second factor is, what is the outcome? Is it positive? Is it neutral? Or is it negative? So the first is unconditional positive, and generally associated with positive outcome is someone we would call a friend. You're from Sweden, and I know in many countries in the world, there's a whole elaborate ritual before you get to address somebody in an informal way. My first language was German, and I know that you don't talk to somebody in a formal way immediately. There's a more formal way you address somebody, and then there's a whole series of steps before you become closer. In the United States, however, everybody's everybody's friend, right? We just met this evening. We're on a first name basis. My good friend Mike. It means nothing. Everybody knows it means nothing. So I'm trying to be very precise about what is a friend. A friend is an unconditional relationship. It's an unconditional positive relationship. It doesn't matter about time or circumstances. For example, I've got a guy who I met in high school. We're friends. I think over the last 5 years, I've spoken to him twice. And yet when my daughter moved to New York and she needed somebody to co-sign the loan, I called him and said, would you do it? And I knew he would say yes. And his home burnt down. And I called him. I said, you want to move in with us? And of course, yes. I mean, I would do that. But it had nothing to do with the amount of time we've spent together. It's that kind of relationship. If he died, it would be a void in my life. But it's not about time. So it's an unconditional relationship. I'd like you to take out a piece of paper and think about a friend in your life and write down that person's name. You're not going to need to share it, but just write that person's name equal friend. Again, it's an unconditional relationship, usually associated with a positive outcome. And that's a friend. In business, we often don't have many friends. Your friends may be outside business. This is what we call colleagues. And like here are two mothers. They're in a playground and they're just checking schedules. They happen to be at the playground at the same time. Their kids are playing together. And so they don't have any relationship outside the playground. They're just doing work. So a colleague it's a neutral affect. You don't like the person, you don't dislike the person, it's neutral. And the outcome is often neutral. We're checking schedules, we're going to a meeting together. It's not positive, it's not negative, it's neutral. Can you think, write down the name of somebody in your life that is a colleague? In other words, somebody who occupies a space, a professional space that you occupy, but it's a neutral relationship. You don't think positive about them. You don't think negative about them. The work you do together is not positive or negative. They're just there. When I was on the faculty, there were a number of, I was at Suffolk University, and I still am. The number of professors in my department, we're in the same department. I would call them colleagues. We go to meetings together. We serve in committees together, but I'm neutral about colleagues. So write down the name of a colleague. We talked about friends. The next is enemies. And the enemy is the mirror image of the friend. An enemy is unconditional affect, negative. And it's usually associated with a negative event. But the key thing about an enemy, it's unconditional. The enemy wants you dead or gone. It doesn't matter which, frankly. And they just hate you. You may have done something to deserve it. Maybe you didn't. But they want you dead or gone. And you can, you feel it. Can you write down the name of somebody in your professional life that you consider to have been an enemy of yours?
Do you have to feel the same way?
No, you don't. Okay. Any questions? Anybody have any difficulty figuring out an enemy? No? And again, it's the nature of this relationship, it's unconditional. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you say. They just hate you.
But Larry, my enemy tells me it's not personal.
Right. The next is adversary. Now, notice we've gone from unconditional to conditional. And an adversary is an opponent who is opposed to you at this particular time, in this particular place, on this particular issue. But on another time, another place, another issue, that opponent could be an ally. So it's a fluid relationship. In other words, you can't be my enemy and you can't be my friend at the same time. But you could be my adversary and my ally at the same time. So it's a much more fluid relationship. Can any of you think about an adversary? Write down the name of the adversary. And again, the adversary can become an ally depending on the particular issue. Finally, and the last word we're going to be learning tonight is chums. So this is an example of an ally. Chums are allies with benefits. Well, a chum is an ally that you're doing work with for positive outcome for you and them, but you actually enjoy being in their company. But they're not a friend, because a friend is an unconditional relationship. No matter what you do, they're going to be your friends. And you know it. With a chum, they can turn on you if it's in their interest to turn on you, and you know it. Can you think of a chum in your life? So write down the name of a chum. So, we've now gone through the basic diagnostic model. Allies, enemies, friends, chums, adversaries. Now, let's talk, how do you manage chums? Because again, I think for you, the key differentiator to be successful, assuming that you're technically competent, let's assume everybody in the room is technically competent, is how do you manage the chums in your life? First of all, contrary to popular wisdom, it is not lonely at the top. I've met lots of CEOs, you know lots of CEOs, and the most effective CEOs are not lonely at all. Their lives are filled with chums. Very few friends, but chums, lots of chums. And actually, that can be quite satisfying. Harry Truman may have been correct. He once said, if you're in Washington, D.C., and you want a friend, get a dog. Being in D.C., that's not a place where you make good friends. Again, whether you're on the right side of this issue or the liberal side of the issue, what I'm finding is that over the last few years, the opportunities in D.C. to create chumship have decreased. And there's been much more enemies. And that sort of has polluted Washington, D.C. and made it more difficult to get things done. Whether you agree with the politics or not, it's just bad for America that happens. Again, now I'm going to talk about some of my work and some of the problems that I'm seeing with knowledge workers. This is very typical in my work with chief financial officers. They say, my friends are at home, not at work. That's true. Absolutely. But what about your chums? Are they at work? What about people who could be converted from colleagues to chums? Are you spending enough time doing that? The people who know how to convert allies into chums are known in professional services as rainmakers. Scott knows that world extremely well. Rainmaking in professional services, and many of you are wanting to start your own businesses or have your own businesses, basically making rain in the professional services is about chumship. You're good at what you do, and so are your competitors. It's the ability to take somebody who is a ally, convert him into a chum. That's a rainmaker. And here's a story. I was working with one of the two largest CPA firms, and they saw this partner as having potential to become a rainmaker. And I asked him what he loved to do, and he loves to play golf. I said, where do you play golf? At Leo J. Martin, which is, how many of you know Leo J. Martin? It's a public golf course in Newton. Nothing wrong with Leo J. The problem is that not many partners of private equity companies and venture capital firms golf at Leo J. And so, you know, my recommendation to this partner was the firm pay for his membership in the golf club in Brookline, where demographically a lot of partners in private equity firms and venture capital firms are members, and start chumming up with that particular group. Same thing, another director of treasury. As a woman, she likes fine wine. That's great. So if you like fine wine, why don't you take people out for wine sampling to do the things that you like to do? And that's a good example of chumship. Remember, chumship is not about friendship. This is not about making friends. It's about making chums. This is a picture that I took. I don't know if you can see this, but it's. I took it in Madrid. I was walking in Madrid. It was hot, it was humid, and this door was open, and I took the picture. And so here's the door. It's opened into the street, and over here is a little courtyard. And then on the other side of the courtyard is the private entrance. And I thought that symbol really symbolizes what chumship is about, the courtyard. It's that little space that is not public, it is not private, it's in the middle, it's the courtyard. And it's the courtyard where you make chums. What do I mean? The courtyard moderates your mood before you enter. Here's a lovely courtyard, and you're going to go down this pathway till you get to the front door. Probably by the time you get down this pathway, you're going to be feeling a lot better about the world because it's such a beautiful path. The courtyard is not a private space. It's not a public space. It's somewhere in the middle. Courtyards moderate natural temperature. This is the physical courtyard where chumship often takes place. It's called a golf course. My daughter went to Stanford Business School. She was required to take a 2-credit course in golf. That's how important it is at Stanford Business School. Why is it that important? Because you got 4 hours with someone and you're not going to be talking about golf. And anyone in this room who's saying, I don't like golf because it's 4 hours, what am I going to do for 4 hours? You don't get it. It's not about golf. It's about chumship. Here's another way where chumship happens, and many of the people in this room understand it. That's committee work at professional associations. Many of the people in this room are members of, they've been former board members of FEI, or they're current members of the FEI career board. This is where you make chums. You get to work with people, get to see who you like, but it's not about friendship, it's about chumship. So committee work, if you're going to manage your career, if you're going to manage your professional practice, be strategic about what committees are you going, what associations are you going to join, and what committees are you going to get on. If you think just by going to the cocktail party that's the same as joining an association, you don't get it. It's the committee work where the work gets done. It's the committee work where the chums are made. It's not about friends. Wine tasting is an excellent source, because not only are you drinking wine, you're talking about other things. You can bring your spouse. It's a very nice and relaxing way to do that. So you don't have to go to the golf course. But again, these are courtyards. It's not work. It's not, but it's not your private space either. It's in the middle. Similar, the virtual world. Facebook is the courtyard of the virtual world. It is really not the place where you really talk about your private feelings. It is really not the place to talk about your business either. The business public persona for that is called LinkedIn. How many of you are on LinkedIn? How many of you are not on LinkedIn? Okay, you should be on, everybody should be on LinkedIn. That's your public persona. But your courtyard persona is Facebook. This is where you reveal another side of yourself, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's personal. Why is the management of courtyard time important? One is, for those of you who are in professional services, it's about attracting and retaining business. And people like to work with people that they like. If I'm looking for an accountant, the world is full of accountants. The issue is, do I like you? That's really what it's about. It's not, but it's not friendship. It's chumship. So. Another thing about chumship, it helps balance the work-life conflict. So, for example, when my daughter was 9 years old, I dropped one of my association memberships, but then I got involved with my church religious education committee, and I got on that committee and developed chumships with senior executives who were also on that committee. So I was able to do something as a father, but also do something in developing chumship. And that those relationships developed in business for me. Having chums at work gives zest to work. You know, again, work is work. And it's having chums to that you enjoy being with that gives it the zest. And then finally, who's going to help you when you're in between jobs? It's not going to be your enemies. It's going to be your chums. The more chums you have, the better. Again, the whole issue about diagnosing being very important. I've seen so many situations where you have an executive who's been in a job and thought, I have these friends. And then as soon as she's fired, none of these friends are talking to her anymore. And they treat her like she's invisible. And they don't call her, or they don't return her calls. And then she starts feeling bad about herself and angry about the company and angry about other people. Nobody likes me, everybody hates me, I'm going to eat some worms. Remember that song? Well, no, the issue was never that. It was you misdiagnosed the situation from the beginning. They were never friends. They were chums. And now that you can't help them, there's no need for them. It was never about friendship. You misdiagnosed the situation. Shame on you. So, you've got a piece of paper. I'd like you to take out your piece of paper. What are you going to do Monday morning at 8 o'clock or tomorrow at 8 o'clock based on this conversation? Is there anything that you could do differently in terms of diagnosing people that you're going to be working with this week? You don't have to discuss it, but I'd like you to write it down so that you come home with a plan.
I was just going to say, you can pick sort of a list of who's who in your life.
Yeah.
You know, who's important, who do you want to... Yeah.
Or more precisely, who are the allies in your life that you could possibly cultivate into chums? Who are the people where there's currently no emotional bond that you could cultivate into an emotional bond? So I'll give you a couple of minutes. Think about the other thing about who are the colleagues you have. Do you want them to remain as colleagues? Yep. Hold on. Say again?
Do you think it's worthwhile investing energy in converting enemies to chums?
No.
No?
You're wasting your time.
Just wondering.
If you've diagnosed it correctly, well, let me say yes and no. If you've diagnosed it correctly, just you want to avoid them. Just avoid them. But maybe you've misdiagnosed it. And that's a possibility. Let me give you an example. As I mentioned, I do a lot of work at universities. So one of the universities, a large university, and in this university, this professor is the primary researcher for something. It's a $32 million grant. That is a big amount of money. It is such a big amount of money, this professor has an entire floor dedicated to his research. And let's say it's called the Stiebel Lab. And he gets students from all over the world who want to come and study under him. He's a big deal in this field. Well, he gets it in his mind that, what's your name?
Angela.
Angela is the chairman of the department, and Angela is my enemy. And he diagnoses Angela as an enemy. And he is the kind of guy, like a lot of professors I know, that once he's diagnosed the person as an enemy, he wants everybody to feel that way about Angela. And so he creates an environment where even the young professors have to side with him against Angela if they're going to get tenure, because he could block their tenure. The PhD students have to side with him against Angela. So that is so he's created this extremely hostile environment in the department, and it's paralyzing the department. So I go to Angela, the chairman of the department, and I say, is there nothing where the two of you can agree on? And he says, well, actually, there's one thing we both agree on, the importance of getting more women PhD candidates in science. Oh, I've heard Professor Steibel talk about this plan A, B, C. Angela says, oh, I think it's a good plan. I'd support that. I said, okay, so we're going to do a test. I'm going to suggest to the professor that he propose this plan. And when he does, you will say, I will support the plan. Okay. So I go back to the professor and I say, okay, we've got the diagnostic model, and you bought into the diagnostic model. If Angela is truly an enemy of yours, she will oppose everything that you want simply because you proposed it. If, on the other hand, she's an adversary, she may accept your model about women while opposing other things that you're doing. That means your diagnosis is wrong. She's not an enemy, she's an adversary. And an adversary could become an ally. No, you'll never be friends with Angela. You'll never even be chums with Angela. That's not important. Let's test the model. Is she really an enemy? So at the faculty meeting, he gets up and he proposes something to help more women get on in the PhD programs. Angela says, I think that's a great idea. I'd love to work with you on that. He comes back and says, I guess I was wrong. I misdiagnosed Angela. She's an adversary of mine. She's not an enemy of mine. So that helps to tone it down. The idea is to have a decision-based system that is objective in its rules. It's not based on how you feel, but there's some decisions and there's some rules. Again, people who are quantitative oriented, whether they're finance people or whether they're scientists, they like rules-based, evidence-based frameworks. We're providing that to them. Any questions? Okay. So one of the things that I'm learning, and this is particularly true for those of you in firms, professional service firms, it is better to have many thin threads of chumship relationships than one big cable. I go back to the dinner conversation I had where my friend said he felt comfortable because a partner of his in a law firm had a relationship with a general counsel at Merrill Lynch. Well, the problem when you have a one cable relationship is that your competitors know how to snip that cable. They have the tools to snip it. Also, as soon as that general counsel of Merrill Lynch loses his job, where are you? And then finally, if the partner, like what happened at Tester Hurwitz, should die, should leave, where are you? So it's better to have many thin strands of chumship. What that means in a company, like a professional services company, is not one rainmaker, but many, many drizzle makers, many, many having lots of thin strands instead of one big strand.
You forgot the other piece of that, too. What if you misdiagnose that he's not actually a chump? He's actually just has the ability to yank that thin, strong cable and yank you all over the place and ruin your career.
That happens, too. Then you've misdiagnosed. Has that ever happened?
No, I'm saying, I think of this from being a manufacturing guy from a supply chain side.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. You can't depend on one entity because of numerous reasons, whether it's they can go out of business or they can have problems or
right.
or whatever. But the bigger issue is, I see this, is you're setting yourself up for disaster by just only knowing one thing about one entity as opposed to having multiple different
right.
sources of information and product.
Any questions, concerns, issues about anything that I've said tonight? So I want to thank you. The summary is, first we talked about the knowledge worker paradox. The knowledge worker paradox is extreme sophistication in diagnosing issues within one's technical sphere of competence combined with extreme sloppy thinking in terms of diagnosing relationships. Not a problem as long as you're an individual contributor. Big problem if the work has to be done with and through others. What we try to do is to try to call relationships by their proper name, so there's a common language that you and your team could talk about things like the, just, you know, is this person really a chum or is he really something else? So you can't have a conversation about something until you have an agree upon language. Finally, to be clear about the difference between an enemy and an adversary, chum versus a friend, and how do you manage both chumships in the real and virtual worlds? And again, Facebook is your key to manage chumship in the virtual world. You know, I would, how many of you are on Facebook? A few of you are. You know, I would suggest everybody get on Facebook and look at the messages. Again, part of the message, you know, the way I use Facebook is to show another side of me other than the business side, but not necessarily to reveal personal things about me, but to show another side.
It's for those of us who are not on Facebook,
yeah,
therefore haven't looked at your profile, what kinds of things would that be?
Oh, you
hear horror stories about people putting personal stuff they shouldn't.
Yeah, people who sort of don't get Facebook, I've seen this. You know, they'll take a picture of a salt shaker, and they'll send it out to everybody that they know, like somebody cares. I've got a partner who literally will take a picture of his dessert and send it out to people. Who cares? What I do is, for example, on Friday night, my daughter and my son-in-law took me to Lincoln Center Jazz. And I'd have a picture of myself and my daughter and my son-in-law, and then I talked about that I like jazz. That's not, there it is. Yeah, there's Scott has it. So now you know something about me, but it's not really personal. It's that I like jazz. So if you like jazz, maybe we could go to some jazz thing together. That's fine. But I'm not going to get into really personal kind of things on Facebook. So I know what the boundaries are. So it's, again, it's chumship that I'm looking for. Yep?
I'm thinking for anybody who doesn't like Facebook, I'm not a fan.
I'm not going to go
there. But anyway, maybe subscribing to a blog, or there's also meetup.com. There's a lot more substance to that than if you have a hobby like traveling or
Sure. Knitting,
whatever it may be.
The idea is to show another side of yourself other than the business side. Yep.
With regard to Facebook, you can segregate your contacts into different groups and control what each group sees. So you can have your personal life, and those sorts of things, and also your professional life, and you can keep the two segregated by the groups that people are in.
And if you want to look like you're under 40, you actually aren't on Facebook at all. And you're over on Twitter.
Exactly.
And if you want to look like you're under 20, then you're over on Instagram, like my daughter is, teenager is. And my son's on something I don't even understand, and he's 12, so it keeps changing.
Right, it keeps changing. If you would like more information about this, I've got two articles in MIT Sloan Management Review, and those are the URLs for those articles. Or just give me your business cards and I'll be glad to send the articles to you. Jim?
How do you guard against making the wrong read on whether someone is a friend, an enemy, an adversary, or an ally?
I think the key issue is enemy versus adversary. And the key problem is like that example that I gave, a misdiagnosis, that you are an enemy of mine. You really will not be happy until I'm dead or I'm out of FEI forever. Whereas I may have misdiagnosed it. And again, that's why I think it's important to have decision-based rules and a common language. So in the case that I gave, what I said to my professor was, if the chairman truly is an enemy, the chairman will oppose what you just said simply because you said it and doesn't want to give you the credit. if the chairman says, that's a great idea, thank you for suggesting the idea, I'll be glad to work with you on the idea, it can't be an enemy.
Right, but everyone doesn't have the benefit of a mediator like you.
Okay.
To go between them, especially in small companies.
Right.
So how do you guard, should you just assume that?
I think part of my purpose is to have a common language so people can talk about it. So let's say it's a small group, and you're with Scott, and you say, Scott, you know, I think Larry's an enemy of mine, and he's just out to get me. And Scott may agree with you, or he may say, I'm not sure. I don't think Larry likes you. But that doesn't mean he can't work with you.
So we can still be, you
can work with your adversaries. Many of us do that all the time. There's no big deal. But you can't work with your enemies. And actually, we see this going on in politics right now. I mean, the Islamic State in Syria and in Iraq, ISIL, is positioning itself as an enemy. You know, we're out to kill you. Any questions? whereas Russia under Putin, he's more an adversary. He's doing this because it's in his interests. But he's an adversary, he's not an enemy. ISIL, they're enemies.
So your enemies are probably few and far between.
Your enemies are going to be few and far between. And
your case, maybe not.
I think the reality is that the danger is not that you don't recognize your enemy. The danger is you misdiagnose people who are adversaries and call them enemies, treat them as enemies, and then they become enemies, and then you say, see, I was right.
Is there a hierarchy? Is that the high-hanging fruit that you really want to convert all your allies to chums or all your colleagues to chums first and then worry about somebody who's...
In terms of how do you manage your time, the easiest is to identify who are the high-potential allies that I could convert to chums. That's the easiest, it's the most fun way for you to spend time. Spending time trying to convert an enemy into an adversary is probably pretty negative. But the most fun is finding people that have either neutral and convert them to something positive, and I convert an ally to a chum. Again, as I said in one of the slides, for effective executives and effective leaders, it's not lonely at the top, it's just filled with chums. Very few friends, but lots of chumps. Any other questions? Again, if you'd like a copy of any of these slides, if you'd like a copy of the MP3 tape, just send an email to me or give me your business card. I'll be glad to send them to you. lstibel@stibelpeabody.com. Thank you very much. Michael?
Sorry. Larry, this is... Wow, just mind-blowing. This is just great, great stuff.
Thank you.
Do you have something where, because you were talking off the slides, as good presenters do, where you repeat what the definitions of these are?
I've got something that it's a draft I'm working on, but I'm glad to send you what I'm working on.
Yeah,
sure. Just email it to me.
Because I know. And most of us, I assume, mistake chums and friends, for example.
Right. I've got an MIT Sloan Management Review article on how to manage your enemies, and it deals with this model. So I can send you that.
Please.
And then the one that I'm working on right now. Just email it to me. I'll be glad to send it to you. Or give me your business cards. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Wonderful presentation. Before you go, I just want to
say, if you haven't signed in already, I just, because I will be sending out your slides
thank you.
Probably tomorrow at this point, just an email just regarding this, it's the Alton Network and so on and so forth. Secondly, our next session will be here. We'll be here all this year. This is Building a Network for Career Success with Kim Littlefield. She's a perennial favorite. And that will be on Tuesday, October 21st, 5:30 to 8 p.m. Hope you can come. Bring a friend. We'd like to grow this audience. I think it's a great group tonight. I'd like to make it bigger. Thank you very much. We'll see you in a month.
Can you talk about Kim a little bit?
Would you like to?
Kim, I would like to. If you attend next month's presentation, and this is sort of an update of justifiably famous How to Work a Room talk that she's given for several years, and I've heard it many times and it's great every time. But you will find, for example, if you go to an FAI meeting, that you will get more out of that meeting. You'll get more out of every damn meeting you ever attend if you come to this and really get it. So I can't speak highly enough about this next one. It will improve every meeting you ever attend.
What's the date again?
October 21st. We always do things the third Tuesday of every month.
It will not conflict with the World Series this year.
Not that I care. So Kim is wonderful, though, and we invite her back every year because of that. And I think Mike will be the host of that next month. So hope you can attend. Thank you very much for coming tonight, and hope to see you next month.
Thank you. Nice job.
Thank you, Tim.
Look forward to meeting this fellow in 6 hours.
I'll be sending him, you both
What's
of you. Thank you very much. I'll send you.
As soon as you figure it out.
Do you have anything on how to kill your enemies?
Yeah, but I can't publish it.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Great presentation.
Thank you. Let me shut this off.